Ending all forms of affirmative action in schools and hiring decisions is a long-standing goal and promise of right-wing politicians. The reactionary wing of the Supreme Court delivered on that promise last month in ruling that admission policies at Harvard and the University of North Carolina that included race as a factor were unconstitutional and therefore not lawful under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The decision makes using race as a factor in college admissions illegal. Well, Mike, in the commentary since the ruling, there are a range of assessments on its significance and its scope. What's your assessment?
Well, it's a continuation of the Supreme Court's essential racism and willful blindness to the fact that this country was constructed on the basis of slavery, and that our efforts to end the impact of slavery have sputtered and frequently have been brought to a halt by Supreme Court decisions. You know, with the conspicuous exception of the 50s and 60s during the Warren Court and the Brown versus Board of Education decision, the High Court has been consistently against anything and everything that would modify the profound impact of slavery. It has done its best to gut the Equal Protection Amendment and did so right after the Civil War in a series of cases called the Slaughterhouse Cases and the Civil Rights Cases. It did so in Plessy v. Ferguson, which essentially created Jim Crow by legitimizing segregation by allowing first schools and then swimming pools and virtually every part of life to be completely segregated, and gave a huge boost to the rebirth of the South and the lost cause ideology that led to the construction of all those statues of Confederate generals and monuments to the South that popped up all over that region during the first part of the 20th century. Finally, in the Brown v. Board of Education, the Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, very unlike the one we're talking about today, held that separate but equal is a myth, that it's not at all a reality, but even if it were a reality, it would still be a permanent stigma, and decisively rejected the whole idea of segregated education and therefore segregated life as a lawful construction.
Now, in some of the citing of Brown versus the Board of Education, justices seem to acknowledge this history, but as Sandra Day O'Connor decided almost 25 years ago, affirmative action is important as a historical effect, lingering effect of slavery and Jim Crow laws, but that it's long past as an issue. So the judges seem to argue that yes, there is this history, but it's kind of a PTSD syndrome for Black people. They have to get over it, the lingering anxiety that's no longer anchored in reality. In fact, there are people, clinicians, who talk about PTSD among Black people as an effect of slavery, which implies that it's a kind of collective neurosis you have to shake off. What's your take on that argument, which doesn't deny that history you cite, but argues that we have to put it behind us?
Well, that's not at all what they decided. They decided that it was completely a historical decision. They said that the best way to get rid of racism is to get rid of racism. And the best way to end racial discrimination is to end racial discrimination. So they simply do not acknowledge and make only the most fleeting reference to the fact that there has been a long history in this country of racism, beginning with treating Black people as commodities to be bought and sold and tortured and raped at will. Any effort whatsoever to make reparations, and that's what affirmative action basically is slapped down by this court. The fear that they have that emanates from their decision comes from the fact that they're closing their eyes completely to this long history. Justice Roberts is very clear on that he's assuming that we're beginning from day one today and saying henceforth there cannot be any consideration of race, thus ignoring the past several centuries and the fact that race, contrary to what he says, does matter.
Yeah, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson made this point in her dissent and described it as a let them eat cake obliviousness to the role of race in daily life. You're saying that also this concern about the partisan nature of the Supreme Court has a long history and is on mighty display today, but has this long history to it. What's your take on that argument that the Supreme Court has become now so partisan that risks its losing its legitimacy?
Well, that's the best part of this case, is that the Supreme Court has undermined itself in so many ways with making decisions like the Dobbs decision that are really deeply against what most Americans feel. Also with their endemic corruption and the fact that it's clear that nobody can really do anything about it. They can accept millions of dollars worth of luxurious benefits from people who have direct interest in cases that they decide, and no one can call them up on it. One striking thing about this opinion are the dissents. It's not at all like Brown, which was all unanimous, nine people all on the speaking in one voice. Here we've got concurrences ranging from grumpy to self-justifying, and we've got dissents that are extraordinarily strong and well-written, one by Justice Sotomayor that really takes apart the legal reasoning and Justice Roberts' effort to discuss and rely on and distinguish earlier cases like the Bakke case or the Grutter case that have addressed this issue in the past. And Ketanji Brown Jackson does a stunning job of summarizing real life of racism, the fact that not only were Black people tortured and commoditized during slavery, but after Jim Crow, up until very recently, they were not allowed to get home loans. The FHA, created in 1934, explicitly refused to extend loans to Black people. So the main generator of wealth in this country, the ownership of a house, was flat denied to Black people until not long ago. So she takes two applicants to the University of North Carolina, both of them smart, capable, love their state, want to advance. One of them with seven generations of prosperous activity in the community, the other with one, because his ancestors were commodities, and then she runs through all the restrictions that have weighed Black people down in North Carolina since they first came to North Carolina. And
including schools and different experiences through schooling that prepare them for college.
So she's looking at real life and where race does matter, and particularly in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. I think everybody, regardless of your reaction to that, would recognize that race does matter. People can say that they can cast all kinds of aspersions on the people demonstrating against the police. They can support all those demonstrations saying they're far overdue, but nobody in their right mind would say that race does not matter.
You know, Mike, one line of commentary, including among progressives and areas of the left, has focused on the winnowing down of affirmative action rulings and moving away from anything that has to do with reparations to Black people themselves or people of color, and instead arguing legally that the interests of universities is in the diversity of their communities. And so it becomes a add people of color and mix, you know, that you need this diversity for a vibrant campus. And even on those grounds, of course, that there are ways of arguing for affirmative actions. Actually, in recent years, with the economic problems and the pandemic and other factors accumulating in a way that makes minority representation in many campuses less than it was 5 years ago. It's still harder to argue on those grounds. Would you give any weight to that affirmative action has lost a lot of its progressive edge as it's moved toward this more ambiguous area of creating a diverse university community rather than anything related to reparations?
Well, I don't see them as contradictory at all. I think that was a big argument of North Carolina, that we have a better campus, that people learn more in law school classes, they learn more in any sociological class, they learn more in any class, even hard sciences, by experiencing diversity, and that discussions are livelier, more to the point, people advance. There are ways of quantifying that were made part of the record before the Supreme Court. So I think the obligations that we have to make reparations are not at all limited by the fact that, in truth, the diversity has real-world advantages of all sorts, emotional, quantitative, qualitative, of expanding people's understanding of the world in which they live. It's a good thing, and that North Carolina demonstrated that with all sorts of studies and anecdotes, but the Supreme Court waved them off as saying, the colleges say, quote, trust us, close quotes. But they say we cannot do that given the equal protections requirement of strict scrutiny and the fact that you haven't told us exactly how long it's going to last and what it's the two or three beefs they have with the fact that it's not going to be something that has an ending in sight. I mean, Ketanji Jackson says that the end will come when we have created a truly colorblind society, that people have access to opportunity, everyone has access to opportunities. That's when it will end. But that's, as you said, Andrew Day O'Connor said, well, let's do this. I think 25 years ought to be enough. That'll clean everything up for the past few centuries.
Well, let's talk about the next 25 years that we've got ahead of us now and how we might navigate this terrain. You know, the white supremacists in the South refused to comply. They were forced to, some with government marshals at the doors of their schools, but they continued to fight even with the dismantling of segregation, and they're still waving their flags today. So in terms of the potential for resistance to this decision, I think it's interesting to look at Justice Amy Coney Barrett herself and her worries about reactions to Supreme Court decisions that are out of step with how many, if not most, Americans think. She said on a recent speaking tour that, and this is paraphrasing a long speech, that she was there to convince people that the court was not just a group of partisan hacks, because if that's how the court is viewed, then their authority is going to be limited and checked by people, by democratic institutions who say, why are you the ones that get to decide whether, for example, we can regulate very dangerous firearms, whether we can address climate change, and whether we can respond to the host of all the other current day problems that you know we are struggling with? So, Mike, is there some grounds for her worry? Why this group of people that can decide the fate of so many, if not most, people living in this country?
Well, she's exactly right. That's the best thing that can come out of this decision, is the fact that the Supreme Court made it. That court is held in such low regard across the board in this country. It's going to create a pall over the legitimacy of this affirmative action decision. And as you wrote, that is, in many ways, most people don't like affirmative action because they don't really, it has not been understood clearly, and it's people who are advocating it feel somehow guilty about it. The fact that the Supreme Court, and it has no army of its own, she's right, it requires respect for its decisions to count. I'm grateful that they are held under such low regard, because that makes, paradoxically, different sorts of affirmative action really possible, really saleable on a large scale. It really becomes easier to explain why it's beneficial for everyone, and as well as being a moral obligation.
And does this have the potential for widening discussion, educating about both the limits of affirmative action at elite schools that most people of color and working class white people are not able to attend because they're financially prohibitive? So there's that narrow path that is offered to the what used to be called the talented 10%. But I think widening public discussion about the purpose of education and who is admitted to these prestigious schools and all of the hierarchies that are formed around them and their prestige, as well as alliances between working class people of color and white people who are not able to buy houses anymore, not able to get an education, who cannot, you know, borrow $50,000 a year to put your kids through school. What do you see in the prospects on that front of broadening the movement for truly public education?
Well, I've been really heartened by the fact that now people are actually talking about all over the place the notion of legacy admissions. The truth is that Harvard is, people think it's all for smart people, but it's really all for well-connected people. It's part of the creation of an aristocracy in the United States. 43% of the white people attending Harvard now are there as a, quote, legacy. That means it's a hand down, something you inherit, that you, namely the right to enter Harvard. You know, Jared Kushner was admitted to Harvard the year after his father gave Harvard $2.5 million. If you have parents who can give a school $2 million, you're going to get in. That's the way it works.
And you people, don't see the spotlight on these people very often, and they question themselves, do I really belong here, or was I just admitted because of connections, which is what people of color are, you know, have to deal with, that cloud of doubt around whether they really belong there. Apparently, Clarence Thomas has never gotten over his own anxiety about that. So yeah. There is also this discussion on a more practical level of abandoning many of the traditional measures, SAT scores and other measures where you have cutoff points that are adjusted for groups under affirmative action, instead relying on letters of recommendation from teachers or essays where the life experience of students is given more emphasis. Those are also very time-consuming ways of evaluating applicants, and also have benefited from were students who've had the resources to get coaching on those materials. So that does not deliver us from the history of these same dynamics, but it seems to acknowledge in a way the subjectivity and sort of the arbitrariness of some of these factors that separate people into meritorious and less meritorious piles.
Well, that's true. And this decision will trigger all kinds of creative ways of surmounting itself. I mean, there are avenues left open by the majority that allow you, for example, to talk individually about the impact of race in your own life. There are things that can be done and should be done, and it will be done to counter this. But it will have, it's its broad effect beyond just people trying to squeeze into high prestige universities, just as Brown v. Board of Education or Plessy v. Ferguson, the initial case that legitimized segregation, each reverberated far beyond the particular topic they were dealing with, because they set forth a principle about race. You know, are we going to consider race? Can races be treated distinctly? Must they be, you know, these principles that will be derived from this are what we need to be afraid of and to combat, and which we need to be grateful that this court is relatively down now in terms of the prestige with which its holdings are held. One reason why the court is so powerful now, and it is, despite the fact that many people, a growing number of people have a great disdain for the court, is the fact that the legislature has effectively withdrawn. One, it's kind of cowardly, turning things over to the executive or to the judicial branches of government. And the other is it's perfectly split. It's due to the host of different reasons having to do with how legislative areas are drawn, gerrymandering, et cetera. But it's really difficult to undo the court itself. To even limit the court's jurisdiction was perfectly within Congress's power to do. They can strike down the right or the ability of the Supreme Court to rule on the constitutionality of different kinds of legislation. They can, of course, expand the court. They can do various things. But what they really need to do is just get active, do things. Now, they don't do anything, and therefore there's a void of power that the executive branch and the judicial branch have been filling up.
The ACLU calls for turning more to state Supreme Courts. In closing, on this theme of the power of the Supreme Court, would you give any weight to that, or is that too big a topic to take up as we close today?
No, it's the thing to do. It's what this, you know, the last group that truly opposed the Supreme Court was the South, which has always been at odds with the rest of the country. And, you know, in the 18th century, they were economically more akin to Jamaica than they were to New York or Massachusetts. They make a commodity. It's a very rich, lucrative commodity. They sell to people who turn that into manufactured goods. The South has been opposed to the rest of us all its life. It still is every bit as much today.
How can state Supreme Courts resist the decisions of the Supreme Court?
Well, they can and do. They're allowed to do a host of things. The Supreme Court just simply says what the federal Constitution forbids, but it does not say what you can do. If the state constitution allows you to do it, or if you pass legislation, that can be something entirely separate from the particular issue of, like, there's a whole host of, like, states, for example, can and are rapidly passing laws extending the rights of abortion to everyone, to making it easier, to make access easier to abortion. And there's a real strong response to the Dobbs decision by states all over this country. Just in this month, Ohio, for example, is now going to have an abortion issue on the ballot. It's not a famous state for having these kind of people-generated ballot measures. So there's lots of things that can be done on the state level that should be done on the state level.
Reproductive justice and educational justice have some areas of alignment, and yet there's been maybe less palpable organizing around this issue, as we're seeing with reproductive justice. So that there is always room for resistance if we know how to organize and educate. So we'll have to track that, see where the next 25 years takes us.
Well, I hope so.
Okay. Well, thanks, Mike. Stay cool, and we'll continue to follow this.
All right.